G'day, Footyology listeners. Roko here. Enjoy our podcast? Well, you can become an official Footyology podcast supporter simply by using the supporter feature through Acast. There's no subscription or regular commitment, just the sheer satisfaction that comes with knowing you've kept the debt collectors from our door. No, just kidding. It does help, though. If you want to get started, you just need to follow the support this show link in the show description. Thanks again, and now let's get on with it.
Welcome to the Footyology Podcast with Rowan Connolly and Mark Fine.
G'day everyone, welcome to the Footyology Podcast. Oh, we're creeping closer to some serious football action going on. Of course, AFLW very much in swing. We've had four rounds of that this week. Starting today, as a matter of fact, on Wednesday, the first lot of men's scratch matches, the fixture for which we will run through very shortly. We've got a heap to talk about today, as I say. Very good morning to my co-host, Mark Fine. How are you going, Finey?
I'm well, Rowan. Very well. Looking forward to the men joining the fray. AFLW has held the fort nicely, but yeah, very much looking forward to the first round of scratch matches, as you call them. Should be interesting. And onwards and upwards to the AFL season.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm looking forward to. Post-haste, in a couple of hours when we've done this, and is chugging on down to a certain establishment in Albert Park. What establishment would I be talking about?
Andrew's Hamburgers, 144 Bridport Street, Albert Park, and you can chug on down there, and once you're there, enjoy the pride of hamburgers, the pride of Australian hamburgers, a truly Aussie burger, great produce, great end result. Andrew's Hamburgers, 144 Bridport Street, Albert Park.
I'll tell you what, I've done some pretty decent salesmanship during the week too, just getting on to our other sponsor. We have sold our house here at the Connolly Mansions, and the vendors are tossing up whether to renovate or to knock the whole thing down and build again. But I think they're starting to lean towards renovation. And that's where one very, very handy recommendation came into play. Who do you think I might have recommended to them?
West Point Properties, no question about it. Nick Spartels and his team will give them the fashion rebuild or the renovation of a lifetime. Just get onto West Point Properties and you'll be guaranteed of the very highest quality work by people with an eye for great detail.
Well, there you go. That is the quickest intro we've ever done on this show. Why is it quick? Because we have a show jam-packed of hearty podcast goodness, and we're going to get into that right now.
On Footyology Newsfeed.
All right, plenty of news around. Got to start on a somber note, I'm afraid, Finey, and couldn't let this pass without some sort of commentary. And tragic occurrence on Monday, Geelong Football Club stalwart Vic Fuller, who I'm sure a lot of people, even if they didn't know Vic, would have recognised him. He was the doorman for Geelong, not just the doorman. He fulfilled a heap of different roles for the Cats over 50 years of voluntary service down at Sleepy Hollow to the Cats, a magnificent servant of the game. He very sadly passed away from a stroke on Monday. There's no consolation with a story like this, but it happened at training. He was out there doing his usual service, you know, picking up after people and getting things in shape, and he suffered a stroke. They had medical attention on hand immediately, but tragically, Vic couldn't be revived. And it had a huge impact on the place down there. Training was cancelled immediately. Players visibly distressed. And I noticed that yesterday, Joel Selwood, Geelong captain, brought all the players together and paid a really lovely and emotional tribute to Vic. He was the heartblood, the heart and soul of that football club. And it's just devastating for everyone there. But it's very upsetting for any of us who had anything to do with Vic. And look, in my case, it was simply every time you're at a Geelong game and you went into the rooms afterwards, whether working in the press or radio, or if you're a friend or family of players or whoever, Vic was the man who let you in and never failed to greet you with a g'day and your name. He knew everyone, and a beautiful smile, which was captured in a lovely photo I saw in one of the tributes in the media. But just terribly sad. I mean, when you think about it, these are the sorts of people that make our game tick, even at the highest professional level. And you've only got to read some of the tributes on the internet and social media the last couple of days to see the regard in which Vic was held. A lovely, lovely man, and he's going to be terribly missed by a lot of people in football. So a sad, sad occasion, but what a legacy he left for the Geelong Football Club.
Yeah, you know, I think most clubs would have a Vic Fuller. And it just reminds us that even though our AFL clubs are highly professional and generate huge amounts of money and have tens of thousands of supporters, they are still football clubs. And football clubs need people like Vic Fuller to make them operate at all levels. And, yeah, very sad passing, but a great time at your club, whether it's a local club or something, you know, a little bit of higher status, to recognise those volunteers and really be thankful for the work they do.
Yeah, well said. And deepest condolences to Vic's family and friends. Well, when I said there's news going on, you know the season is creeping ever closer when we start having angst and a bit of hand-wringing about new rules. Now, there's a few new rules going on this year. There's the reduction in the interchange cap to 75 per game from 90. Personally, don't think that'll make a shadow of difference. We've had the man on the market kick-ins dragged back another 5 metres. Not sure that'll make a huge difference. One, though, that people are already up in arms about, and that comes after some footage from an Essendon intra-club game, or not even an intra-club game, just some match simulation done by the Bombers on Monday. And it was footage of Darcy Parrish taking a mark. I think it was Kyle Langford on the mark. Now, this new rule, the man on the mark is not allowed to move even laterally on the mark anymore. He has to stay exactly where he is. Darcy Parrish began to move sideways. Kyle Langford crept across in accordance with that and immediately was blown for a 50-metre penalty. And a lot of people looked at that footage and freaked out, basically. Said, this is going to be ridiculous. We're going to have 20 50-metre penalties per game. I'll get your response to the sec. Finding mine, though, was I'm just wondering if it's a lot of to-do about not much, to be honest, because I quite like this new rule. I think of all the devices we've seen brought in the last few years that could make a difference to the game, this is actually one which could be a positive. Not so much in the middle of the ground where this one took effect, but I think when players are marking or awarded a free kick closer to the boundary, it's when that player on the mark moves inboard laterally that effectively cuts off their options in the corridor. If they're not allowed to do that, there is going to be space to go inside into the middle of the ground. And I think that could have a very tangible effect on opening up the game a bit more and making it a bit more attacking and hopefully a little higher scoring as well. I think there will be a period of at least a couple of weeks where players are transgressing and a lot more 50s are paid. But as we see with a lot of new rules, there's a bit of a settling down period and then people get used to it and we see what benefits there are of it. So I'm actually a fan of this rule change and I'd like to see it in operation at least for a couple of games, proper games, before people start throwing up their hands and saying this is a disaster. What do you think of it?
Well, I think that's a reasonable standpoint to say, let's have a look at it for a couple of games. We've got the scratch matches to have a look at the potential impact when two teams are playing each other. I don't like it. I don't like those occasions when players with the ball feign to play on, sort of dummying the man on the mark into movement, earning a 50-metre penalty. Sometimes that happens intentionally, sometimes unintentionally. And I always think about the look of the game, Rowan, and I don't like the look of the game changing too much. And I just hope we don't end up, after a couple of weeks of adjustment, with players on the mark looking like, you know, in netball, when the goal shooter has the ball, the opposition sort of have to try and stand off her, or normally her, and they end up looking like trees swaying in the wind with their feet planted on the ground and the top half moving, or like those very large public attractors at car parks, at car sales, at car yards, you know, the ones
inflatables.
Yeah, with the wind, with the arms flailing in the air but not moving in the bottom half.
I think that's a Family Guy sketch or something, isn't it? Inflatable, wacky inflatable arm man.
Yeah, well, I hope players on the mark don't end up looking like wacky inflatable arm men.
Okay, no, look, fair enough. It'll be interesting to see how people respond to it, but we do have a tendency to run around like Chicken Little when something like this happens and go, the sky is falling. Let's just see some of the sky before we decide it's falling would be my argument.
Good call by you. Let's have a look at how it works before we hate it.
Well, we're going to see how that rule is trialled in some actual games of men's AFL football happening over the next few days. In fact, the first one happening today, Wednesday, as we record this. I'll run through the schedule for those who haven't seen it. Wednesday, February 24th, we have Western Bulldogs taking on Hawthorn. In fact, that game will probably already be over by the time you listen to this podcast. It is underway as we record. Thursday, February 25th, those old rivals, the Blues and the Bombers, Carlton taking on Essendon at Icon Park. That one is at 11 a.m. North Melbourne v St Kilda on Thursday at Arden Street at midday. Friday, we have Melbourne playing Richmond at Casey Fields. That is at 9:30 a.m. Geelong takes on Collingwood at the Cattery GMHBA Stadium at 11 a.m. And four games going on Saturday, February 27th. Port Adelaide taking on Adelaide at Albert and Oval. GWS taking on Sydney at Giant Stadium. West Coast playing Fremantle at Mineral Resources Park. And Gold Coast playing Brisbane at Metricon Stadium. That last game at 4 p.m. Queensland time, which is 3 p.m. Eastern Seaboard time. In terms of entry, don't bother because they are closed to the public. I'm told all games closed to the general public, open to the media. I think most clubs are streaming them live on their websites or via social media. However, I did hear a nasty suggestion that it might only be to members who have access to that, or at least free, and you might have to pay otherwise. So take that up with your clubs if you're a bit miffed by that suggestion. But that is the schedule for the scratch matches, which will be played over the next few days before we move into 1 week of the pre-season competition. Okay, let's move on to our AFLW wrap. And look, I did my rant on women's football last week, finally, but gee, this has been a really, really good season thus far. And underlined again at the weekend, there were some great games and some unexpectedly great games, the pick of which I thought was the clash between Richmond and Carlton. Richmond, of course, still yet to win a game in AFLW competition, either last season or so far this season. Well, they came agonisingly close against the Blues. It was a great game at Icon Park on Saturday, and suitably lauded by most people who watched it. We had a top-of-the-table clash between Collingwood and North Melbourne, which Collingwood won convincingly. But the state of play currently on the AFL ladder, there are now just two undefeated teams. They are the all-conquering Fremantle, who made an absolute mess of Gold Coast at the weekend, and Collingwood, as I said, putting North Melbourne to the sword. There are four teams with three wins, one loss. They are Brisbane, Adelaide, Melbourne and the Western Bulldogs, who are really starting to gather some momentum and had an important and significant victory, I think, over the Demons on the weekend too. What was your highlights of last weekend's AFLW action?
Actually, watched the Adelaide versus Brisbane game. Gee, Lauren Phillips, still a powerhouse. You know, I mean, no question there. But also, saw sort of for the first time, and didn't hate it, a bit of spite between the two teams.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I'm not advocating that we have brawls and melees and the girls go hard enough at the ball. They certainly don't lack for anything in terms of attack on the pill. But it was just interesting to see that the sort of camaraderie that exists between these clubs in the early part of AFLW might give way to a more competitive edge in years to come.
Yeah, well, there was a fair bit of argy-bargy, wasn't there? And, of course, Matty Prasparkas for the Blues suspended for a week after a bit of a sling tackle in that game. And I did notice that myself. I think the main thing emerging in recent weeks is the competitiveness of most teams. It's more competitive a comp this year than last year. And the last game of round four, I think, was the best example of that. It was GWS up against West Coast. West Coast, of course, have, like Richmond, really struggled. But they really gave GWS a lot to think about and a terrific first quarter in that game, which produced seven goals. So scoring was a big target of the naysayers about this competition, but we're definitely seeing more scoring. Seven goals kicked in that first quarter. I mean, let's be honest, in a men's game these days, you'd look at that and say that's pretty par for the course. So the game's a bit more open, I think, a bit less scrappy now. We're certainly seeing longer kicking and better skills and seeing a bit more scoring, and the bottom teams able to hold their own for longer periods against the more adept teams in the competition. So really good signs for this competition. And I'd say to anyone, if you had a look at a highlights package from round four and put it up against, say, round four of the first season of AFLW, which isn't all that long ago, it's only 2017, it's a yawning gap in standard. And that really does augur well for the whole competition, doesn't it?
Yeah, improving exponentially season on season.
All right, that is AFLW for this week, round five coming up this weekend. And now we have the final three of our men's season previews. And this week we are talking about Sydney, West Coast and the Western Bulldogs. Let's get into that.
Cheer, cheer the red and the white.
Well, let's talk about the Swans, Finey, and I'm feeling pretty bullish about the Swans in 2021. Now, they've had consecutive years now without a finals appearance, which, as we all know, is very rare in their modern history. But I'm wondering if they might be, if there's going to be one big surprise this year, I'm wondering if these guys might provide it. There's a lot I like about what they're doing. Let's have a look at their record for 2020. It was 5 wins, 12 losses, and a finish of 16th. The changes to the list, coming onto the Swans list, we have Tom Hickey. He has made his way to Sydney from West Coast. Logan McDonald from Perth. Braden Campbell, very highly rated junior. He's a local boy from Pennant Hills. Errol Golden from University of New South Wales and Eastern Suburbs. Malachi Carruthers, perpetrator of the Malachi Crunch from Happy Days. He's from Sturt. Mark Sheather, also local from Pennant Hills. Going out of the mix for the Swans, Aaliyah is off to Port Adelaide. Jackson Thurlow has been delisted. Elijah Taylor delisted. Riley Stoddart, Zach Foote, Michael Knoll, Jack Mayborn, Harry Reynolds and Brady Rolls, all delisted. So a fair bit of change at the, you could say, the bottom end of the list. But I think Hickey could be a valuable in for them. And I really, really like what some of their kids are doing, Finey. That's the considerable upside. How do you see the Swans in 2021?
I'd be going with Malachy, I think, rather than Malachy. But I think it might be an Irish name. Malachy Carruthers. Tom Hickey, gee, fourth club. Interesting, isn't it? But I reckon he could provide a bit of value to them. Obviously, went to West Coast when they were unsure about Nick Natanui's future. And the fact that Nick Natanui seems to have regained full fitness means that there's not much of an opening for a second ruckman. So, yeah, I think that he could be a handy pickup. I reckon a lot of the optimism around Sydney does still centre around whether or not they can get Buddy onto the pitch.
Mm.
Early reports are a little concerning. It's gone from hamstring to calf, but, yeah, it's just not an easy ask at this stage of a player's career to get them to overcome soft tissue injuries, and it may be a recurring theme that stymies him for the rest of his career and that long contract, which I think is in its second last year. I agree with you, though. There is cause for optimism amongst their youngsters. I was really impressed last year how Nick Blakey, who in fact got dropped during the season, regathered himself and became a better footballer forward, I would have thought. He went into the midfield, so provided some real options for John Longmire in terms of not only being a pop-up sort of forward, but also getting more of the ball through the midfield. I think we saw the, not emergence, but the arrival and potential, not greatness, potential, yeah, greatness of Callum Mills. What do you think of Callum? I think we saw the consistency and the output of a real a top liner last year.
Yeah, look, I think he certainly had a terrific debut in AFL football. Probably plateaued there for a little while, had some injuries. But, yeah, there's a greater maturity and all-roundedness to his game, I think, capable of pushing up into that midfield. I really like the way they're rebuilding their midfield. And I think, you know, even early last season, you're looking at the midfield and saying, oh, it's all about Kennedy and Parker. But we're really starting to see some new faces playing important parts in that midfield now. And to that end, I mean, look, Dean Cox, assistant coach for Sydney, he had a chat to Ronnie Lerner for a piece on the Bolters of 2021, talking about some of their kids. And Nick Blakey, we could see, I mean, he really did have a significant impact moving into the midfield in the second half of last year. And we can see that continue. I think you're seeing greater maturity from the likes of Will Hayward and Oliver Florent. Some of those kids Cox was talking about, well, Dylan Stevens was one. He's very impressive indeed. The guy I really like is Justin McInerney. I think he's only played about 8 or 9 games, but he looked all class, I thought, towards the end of last year. So you really are, I mean, it's a rebuilding program, there's no question about that, but it's happening quickly, and I think those kids are starting to play more important roles. Another guy we haven't mentioned, Jordan Dawson. I mean, how accomplished looking is he coming off halfback? The Buddy thing is a valid concern, but that's where I think Hickey could be important, because he might free up Callum Sinclair to play forward a bit more, and Sinclair is quite a capable key forward, unlike a lot of ruckmen who prop up forward, hoping to take some grabs and kick a few goals. And they will have, fingers crossed, Sam Naismith coming back, hopefully mid-season. So they're going to be an interesting one to watch. We know they've got a great culture. We know they've got a very solid coaching program there, headed by John Longmire. I think of all those sides outside the top eight, they are certainly one of the more likely to really put some heat on those sides in the eight. Where do you see them finishing?
I see them finishing between 10th and 14th.
Yeah, we've agreed on almost everything with this. I'm going to put them just outside the eight. I reckon they can threaten the eight, and I've got them in that bracket, 8-12.
Okay.
So we'll see how that transpires once the serious stuff starts. All right, let's move on to our second team for review this week. Let's look at the Eagles, Finey. Their 2020 record, 12 wins, 6 losses, and a finish of 7th. Of course, bowled out of the finals in week one for a second week in a row in that dramatic one-point loss to Collingwood, the Magpies, playing in Perth with the odds stacked against them. And the Eagles, well, they blew it after having finished, 5th on the AFL ladder. List changes are dramatic, but there's a couple who could certainly add to the mix. They are Alex Witherden coming from Brisbane and Zach Langdon, a talented small forward from GWS. Also coming onto the list, Luke Edwards from Glenelg, Isaiah Winder from Peel Thunder and Zane True from Swan Districts. The outs, Tom Hickey, we just talked about him, he's off to Sydney. Lewis Jetta, delisted. Will Schofield has retired. Hamish Brayshaw, Francis Watson, Nick Reid, Anthony Treacy, and Mitch O'Neill all delisted. Well, Finey, they started terribly last year. The hub life didn't agree with them. They got on a considerable roll, helped by playing at home for a number of weeks in a row. I think it was about 6. They won 11 of their last 13 home and away games and looked very ominous heading into the finals, but it was over as quick as we were wondering how far they could go. Getting on a bit, they've got a few older players now pushing or over 30. What do you make of their chances this year?
I think you hit the nail on the head there, Rowan. Getting on a bit, what can they expect out of Josh Kennedy? Certainly, there's a forward line there that has potential still to trouble most teams. You know, when Kennedy and Darling are on song, they're a very hard duo to stop. The big shining light from season 2020 was, well, nobody ever doubted that Liam Ryan could play football, but he scaled the heights. He's brilliant. How do they use him? It's got to be as more than just a forward. And I think they sort of started getting the formula right in the second half of the season. He reminds me of, well, it reminds me of actually sometimes of Nicky Winmar at his best, but he's a superstar. He really is. So it's best use of that player and best use of Nick Natanui. So they've certainly got the armory to beat any side. Now, whether or not they stay on the field and can put that all together and are fully fit remains to be seen, but I think they're an underrated danger coming into season 2021. Yeah, things have to fall right for them, but they, as I said, they've got the players to go all the way. I really believe that.
Yeah, so do I. I was going to say certainly not underrated by me. I think they are a massive, massive flag chance again. Yes, some of those players getting on, but those players getting on are still contributing in no small way to what's going on. Number least, Nick Natanui, who now in his 30s, but career best season last year, he was just an incredible presence for them in the ruck, finished 2nd in the league for hit-outs, finished 6th in the competition for clearances, a ruckman. All it needs is a little more productivity from that midfield group, and I think they're capable of getting that. I think a huge factor in that could be Tim Kelly. Now, Kelly, I thought, was decent enough last year, but compared to his stellar output at Geelong, people looked at him and thought, oh, gee, bit disappointing. Well, he's only going to take it up incrementally a little, I think, to be a huge part of that midfield mix in turning that midfield combination from solid to potentially devastating. Liam Ryan didn't just come of age, but good enough to make All-Australian honours. he is a huge plus for them. I think their defence is underrated. Really like what the likes of Tom Barrass and Liam Duggan do down there. And talking about scope for improvement, here's the thing. We know how potent their forward setup is. Jack Darling had a really good year last year. Josh Kennedy, yes, he's getting on and did start pretty slowly, but I thought he was as important for them as ever. We've got the likes of Ryan at his feet. You now got a guy like Zach Langdon. He could be really valuable for them as that medium-sized forward, slipping in for goals at the feet of the key position players. Oscar Allen, rapidly emerging talent he is. They've got talent all over the place. I mean, you look at that list as a group of 40-odd, and it stacks up the equal of just about any list in the competition, I think. So, look, the age, it might be a concern in 1 or 2 years. I don't think it's a concern just at this stage. The home ground advantage always got to be huge for them, or the home state advantage. They didn't react well to Hub Life, but I think historically over the last 3 or 4 years, they've been a pretty decent side on the road. And motivation, they'll be stinging because they have been good enough to be a premiership side the last 2 years, in addition to the one they did win in 2018. And twice they've really stuffed themselves up, really, by exiting in the first week of the finals, by missing out on that top four. They make top four, they are a massive chance to win it, I think. And absolutely, I think they're the equal of any other premiership chance in the competition. There is enough on the Eagles. Our final club for review in this series of mini parts, or five parts, and we are talking about the Western Bulldogs. Let's have a chat about them. Sons of the West, red, white and blue, we come out smiling, Bulldogs. All right, the Doggies. Well, this is a side that a lot of people think should be performing better than it is. Of course, they went out in week one of the finals last year as well at the hands of your Saints, Finey. That makes it 2 years in a row that's been the case. But they've come with a rush at their back end of both those last two seasons. And fair to say, they are loading up big time for a serious crack at it. We'll have a look at those ins in a second. Their 2020 record was 10 wins and 8 losses for a finish of 8th on the ladder. The ins, one massive name standing above the others, Adam Treloar for Collingwood. What a pickup he stands to be for a midfield that already is burgeoning with some very handy names. Stephen Martin joins the Bulldogs from Brisbane. Mitch Hannon too, a sometimes underrated medium-sized forward. He joins them from Melbourne. The incredibly highly rated number one pick in the draft, Jamara Ugal-Hagan from Oakley Chargers. A lot expected of him already. Dominic Bedendo from Murray Bush Rangers and Lachlan McNeil from Woodville West Torrens. The outs for the Doggies, Matt Suckling delisted, Tory Dixon retired, Jackson Trengove delisted, Sam Lloyd retired, Billy Gowers delisted, Lockie Young is off to North Melbourne, and Brad Lynch, Callum Porter and Fergus Green delisted. I think there'll be a bit of a bandwagon on the Doggies for this season, as there was, I think, last season. In fact, from memory, I think you might have been on that bandwagon, Finey. Are you on it this year?
I'm a bit more cautious this year. I like the name of one of their recruits, Lachlan McNeil. Is that a sneaky way of trying to get a Lachie Neil into the club?
Very good.
Lachlan McNeil. They got a bit of a bust last year with Josh Bruce, didn't they? They need that second forward. Aaron Norton, a bit of a stop-start career, but we know that if he can get some consistent football, he's a fantastic mark. And even in that final that they lost to St Kilda, really ignited them towards the end of the game and almost won them the match. So the big question mark, really, for me, is how good is Jamara Ugal-Hagan? The reports are that he is already the sort of footballer that could be enough of an impact in his first season to make the Bulldogs a very, very hard team to beat. That midfield is burgeoning with class and options. And those options include allowing Bontempelli to play forward more, because obviously the retention of McRae, the addition of Adam Treloar, Bailey Smith is now a top-class midfielder. Libber does his work and does his work well. You've got Hunter, who's a ball gatherer, Hunter and gatherer. And it means that there's scope there to allow Luke Beveridge to move the playing pieces around and have a very potent forward line. Does the back line stand up as well? Maybe not. Alex Keith was a good addition without being brilliant, but still he takes a tall forward and should be able to do that job ably. Maybe there is a bit to exploit down back, but it just looks like such a powerful team, but they need to play as a team and get the most out of themselves, which they did not last season. Look, Tim English, a couple of times they lost last year and the blame was squarely laid at his feet. And yeah, he did get monstered a bit, which is why I think Stephen Martin's a good inclusion. He'll give him a bit of a chop out and take a little bit of the physicality that was aimed at Tim English and throw it right back at the opposition. I think that's what Steph can do, certainly for a season or two. I've got them... Oh, look, I'm going to put them third to sixth, which means right in the mix, but I don't think that they'll be able to go all the way with the Richmonds, West Coast Eagles and a couple of other teams that I expect, like Port Adelaide, look seasoned and ready for a tilt at the Premiership. So I've got the Bulldogs just behind those clubs. Let's put them third to sixth.
Well, that midfield group, gee, it's a roll call of stars. And one I don't think you even mentioned, Josh Dunkley, who, of course, Essendon tried to poach, the Bulldogs did manage to hang on to him. But Bontempelli, McRae, Liberatore, Bailey, East Melbourne's finest mullet, Smith, Lockie Hunter, Dunkley, Adam Treloar. That has got to be, surely that's the best midfield group in the competition. Martin gives them a bit more flexibility with the ruck. Their defence is an interesting one. It's a fantastic defence and really crucial for them. They generate a lot of drive off half-back. Caleb Daniel, of course, what a fantastic season he had, earning him All-Australian selection. Jason Johannesson, part of that. Easton Wood, Taylor Duray, Bailey Williams, Hayden Crozier. You mentioned Alex Keith. The one but about that defensive group might be just perhaps a lack of height and strength in terms of key position size. But I think that's less of an issue now. There are fewer teams that have genuine, you know, twin towers of attack. Obviously, Richmond with Lynch and Riewoldt, you know, West Coast, Kennedy and Darling. There's not too many, though. And I think they'll be able to exist well enough against the bulk of teams defensively. And as I say, a real offensive weapon for them. This is a pretty significant stat for me and one of my reservations. Interesting, their record against the top eight teams last year was pretty poor for me. It was 1-7, only one win against the top eight, and even that victory was by only 2 points. So they really, are they becoming one of those sides that wins the ones they should, can't measure up against superior opposition? So they're going to have to lift to turn that obvious talent into something a bit more substantial. But I think they're capable of it. I think a huge key will be the continued development of Aaron Norton. If he can really hold his place as a key forward, stay on the park, injuries have been a concern for him, and we see something out of Ugal Hagen, that will serve them very well indeed. So that's an area that needs to improve as well. But even guys we haven't mentioned who can be part of the equation, Sergeant Lipinski, Vandermeer, Bailey Dale, Bruce, you mentioned, you know, he'll be very keen to attain for a pretty ordinary debut season. The talent is all over the place. I don't have quite enough faith for it to make them a top four side. So, yeah, I'd probably have them in that same bracket as you, finishing somewhere between third and sixth. But by the same token, wouldn't be surprised at all if that was turned into something a lot more substantial come the pointy end of the season. That is our review of all 18 AFL sides. If you missed your club, just have a flick back through previous podcasts. We talked about every team's prospects for 2021. The time is right now, Fighting, I think, to kick back and muse on matters of life.
Life hacks. Building a better world.
All right, let's go. I'm going to kick us off this week, Finey. I've been talking a lot about TV in the off-season. It's probably when I do the bulk of my TV watching, none of it on free-to-air TV. I wouldn't inflict that on my worst enemy these days, and we've talked about that too. But I have started watching, of course, I did finally get around to watching Breaking Bad, fantastic. And I thought, look, it's probably time I knocked over another critically acclaimed TV show that the rest of the world has watched, but I haven't. So I have started the monumental effort, because there's a fair bit of it, of watching The Sopranos, Finey. Still in season one. I've got to say, don't get me wrong, not underwhelmed. It is very good. But maybe it's just a legacy of having seen so much in cinematic and TV terms about the mafia and organised crime and that whole Italian gangster shtick, that there's not much you see in these sorts of things that surprises you anymore. I am enjoying, however, having watched about 10 episodes, I am enjoying the concentration on the personal rather than the business aspects. I enjoy the stuff with Tony Soprano and his shrink. I think that's pretty good. I like the stuff with the kids. The cultural references, I think, are pretty interesting too. Certainly very stylishly shot. I love the sort of tourist guide look around New York City. I think that's good fun as well. I can definitely see what the fuss is about. It hasn't grabbed me in the same way Breaking Bad or The Wire did, but that is a pretty high bar to measure yourself against. And I do have the feeling, just the last couple of episodes, I am starting to get sucked into the various characters and becoming very interested in their fortunes. So that is a progress report on my viewing of The Sopranos. I presume you've seen the whole thing. You watch everything.
Yeah, I've seen it all. Look, you're right. I think the first season, I've gone back and seen a few of the episodes from the first season. It develops nicely from here on in, Rowan. Okay. You will get, I think, taken in by the storyline, and a bit of a slow burn looking back at it. So bear with it.
All right. Okay. You're up. Number one, life hack.
Well, I've got a TV show as well, and I was going to do it third, but I'll step in time with you. This is, I reckon, if somebody looked at available TV shows on Netflix and Stan and whatever, and you put them in a list, alphabetically this would come last, and I reckon most people would say, if Finey had to pick from that list, it would be the last program he would pick. But I actually really like period pieces, and on Netflix there's a series called Zed. And I think it's got a subheading of something, the beginning, or this is the beginning, or where it all begins. But it's called Zed. Do you know who Zed might be, Rowan?
Dr. Seuss, but that's an S. No, I don't.
It's Zelda Fitzgerald.
Ah, okay.
The wife of F. Scott Fitzgerald. And it basically tells the story of the lives of the Fitzgeralds. Zelda comes from the South. F. Scott Fitzgerald is a young army man based in her hometown of Montgomery, Alabama, for a short period. And they fall in love and get separated by war, but join up after the war and become the it couple on the social scene in New York and beyond. They're hard livers. I guess Zelda Fitzgerald would be the first person in America you'd say was famous just for being famous. And boy, did they live life to the full. And as I say, I love period pieces and I'm really enjoying this. So alphabetically, the last one you might get to is Z. But keep an open mind. And it's for those who like the past and have even if you've read The Great Gatsby, for example, and many people have and love that book, then it's well worth looking into the lives of Zelda and F. Scott Fitzgerald.
The agony of choice in the modern TV world, all those streaming services, nice little segue to my second life hack, as indeed this is sort of following on the heels of my first one about The Sopranos. I was pretty miffed last night. I've been watching The Sopranos on Foxtel Go or Now or Stop or Proceed with Caution or whatever this one is called. I honestly can't keep up with it. But I'd watched 7 or 8 episodes on that. Went to watch one last night. All of a sudden, it's telling me it's locked and I have to upgrade to be able to watch it. And I thought, hang on a sec, how'd you let me watch the first 8? I don't know if it was a mistake or they've just changed policy midstream. But I then Googled streaming Sopranos and it enlightened me that to watch The Sopranos on streaming service now, I had to sign up to Binge, which is another offshoot of Foxtel. So I thought, oh, bugger it, I've started it. I might as well. It's $10 a month and you get a 14-day free trial. So I signed up to that. So there's another well-earned $10 per month going into the pockets of Rupert Murdoch, which, as you'd understand, fills me with great joy. But I watched a couple of episodes on Binge and then I had a look at what's on offer. It is a pretty impressive array of famous TV series. For example, The Wire's on there. I'm pretty sure Breaking Bad's on there. Seinfeld, Friends, South Park. All those famous TV series, they're on there in their entirety. So it's pretty handy from that perspective. But what are you doing, Foxtel? I mean, you don't give someone access to something and then chop them off in the middle of their viewing because you've decided to shift it to another channel they then have to stump up more money for. And I was about to do that old trick that everyone does with Foxtel, which is ring up and threaten to cancel my membership and have them suddenly offer you a package that's 50% cheaper. But it was late at night. I couldn't be bothered speaking to someone in the Philippines. And I just thought, fork out and subscribe to another streaming service. So I'm now currently, I pay for Foxtel. I pay for Netflix. I pay for Stan, I pay for Amazon Prime, and I now pay for Binge. I mean, you couldn't possibly watch that much TV if you just sat in front of it 24 hours per day. So streaming services are certainly in comparison to Foxtel. They are a lot cheaper, but it all starts adding up. I certainly hope I'll be able to make it tax deductible as a business expense. Although, I don't know, can I really justify watching The Sopranos as a business expense? Well, maybe if my financial situation gets any tougher and I can have a few people extorting money on my behalf, it might be a justified business expense. Give me a few tips how to go about it. All right, that's my second life hack. What's yours?
Well, mine's sort of a bit of a question, a football question, an observation that Sean McKernan, who's playing for St Kilda this year, in 2021, stretches out the McKernan brothers' career. Corey started in 1993. That's 28 seasons of football for these two brothers. And I was wondering whether there are any other brothers whose careers span such a long period.
That's a good question, and I think it's probably unlikely. Yeah, there is a huge age gap between Corey and Sean, isn't there? I think Corey's talked about that. I can't remember what he said in relation to that, but you're right. I don't know. Can you think of any that might even rival it?
It's funny because I looked up the Everetts. You know, Peter Everett started the same year as Corey, 1993.
Yeah, when did Andre start?
When did Andre's finish? He must have finished, what, 4 or 5 seasons ago?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, the McKernans outdo them. look, there might be back in the day, I don't know when the Toomeys started and ended, but I reckon for a pair of brothers, very unlikely that there's any that span more than 28 years.
No, it's 28 years. Wow. It's a good call. We'll get someone who's so inclined might want to check the records for us and see if they can find up with a longer example than that one. All right, my final life hack goes back to the Australian Open Tennis men's final, and not so much the game because that was pretty forgettable, although I did see someone describing it during the game as an epic. I'm buggered if I know why, because it was straight sets to Novak Djokovic over Medvedev and a pretty uneventful game. What was eventful, however, was the post-match ceremony. And look, plenty's been said about it, but I could not believe the booing, not before you take issue with this, anyone, not with regards the government. I would fully expected that. I'm sure they fully expected that. And that's part of the sort of, that's pretty de rigueur at presentation ceremonies when the government's mentioned to boo them. But before that, I'm trying to remember her name, Jane, is it Hardlick or something? She is thanking various people. She's talking about the tournament being a success despite being imperiled by COVID. And all she said was, I'm hoping things will return back to normal next year when the vaccine is being rolled out, at which point half the crowd seemed to break into a chorus of booing. Now, was that because Novak Djokovic is a known anti-vaxxer? So is that suggesting that Novak's fans, because he's an anti-vaxxer, they are anti-vaxxers as well? That would be pretty bloody stupid, let me tell you. So I pondered that, and I didn't like the answers that were being provided by that. But to boo the arrival of a vaccine, which is going to prevent people getting ill and dying, that is just borderline crazy stuff. It's like someone saying, well, we've discovered a cure for cancer and people break into it. Why would you boo that? I cannot for the life of me work out why that was being booed. And, of course, what would happen in the aftermath of that, then certain News Corp opinion columnists would burst forth on the pages defending the people booing that comment about the vaccine because, in their words, it was politicising the tennis. Absolute, oh, look, I'll say it was Rita Penny. Absolute cock-a-nanny bullshit, Rita. That is just crap. It was a comment about hopefully things will go back to normal because the vaccine's being rolled out. How is that a political statement? I'm so tired of this global pandemic being politicised by people. Is there not an issue in the world these days that some idiot can't politicise for their own opportunistic ends? It makes me sick. It really does. And the people booing the arrival of a vaccine, which is going to prevent people getting COVID and dying, have a good hard look at yourselves because that was absolutely moronic behaviour.
Hear, hear. Well said. You want my final hack or you're still fuming?
No. I'll defume while you do your last life hack.
Now, a lot of people would probably jump to the conclusion that when I bring up something like parking fines, I must have just got a parking fine and you've only got yourself to blame when you get a parking fine. I haven't just got a parking fine. And, yeah, you are sort of, you've got yourself to blame if you get a parking fine. But the fact is we do get parking fines, and a mate of mine actually produced one that he got last week and showed it to me during the week. And the question I ask is, are there any checks and balances on how much a city council fines people, or are they just allowed to ramp up these figures to ridiculous amounts? Now, this guy parked in an area. He just said it was a very confusing sign with, you know, it came across as hieroglyphics to him, and he did make a mistake. And he was parking in an area which for 1 hour a week was no standing, I think because of the street cleaners coming through there. And he made that mistake. He was there in the wrong hour. And the fine for that was $198. Now, these fines, they're not matching CPI, certainly not matching inflation, because inflation's pretty low. And I just don't know where the council has the right to continually increase the prices willy-nilly of these parking fines. I mean, is there an ombudsman that checks that you can go to and say, you know what? I mean, this is not a fair amount. You know, my mate Steve admits he parked in the wrong spot, but was aghast at the amount of the fine. Has he got any recourse? I don't think so. And I wonder whether there is any checks and balances on these things, Rowan.
So was it a council fine, did you say?
And
it was a clear way, was it?
No, it wasn't a clear way. It was no standing for 1 hour during the week, like Monday 10 to 11, and he's assuming the street cleaners come through or something. But quite confusingly shrouded amongst parking, standing, parking permit times, etc. And it was all a bit confusing for him, and he got it wrong.
Yeah, it does seem like a pretty steep fine. They are a bit hard to decipher sometimes when there's a whole heap of four or five different directions you've got to follow at various times.
But, you know, the amounts just seem to be sort of increasing at an unregulated rate, I'll say.
Yeah, no, it's pretty steep. I think the only one which exceeds it is that one when it is a clear way and you get towed off to, it happened to me once in St Kilda, towed off to the dingy place in the city where you then pay, about $20,000 and hand over your firstborn and they give you your car back. It does border on extortion times. However, I know a lot of people listening will be saying, fining, well, a simple solution, don't park there at the wrong time. All right, that is enough life hacks. Time now to revisit a year in the past. And this is our last year, Finey. Now, I'm going to spend the next few days desperately coming up with a way of keeping this segment going. If anyone has any good ideas, get in contact with us at the Footyology website or via comments on this podcast or on Twitter or wherever you like. But we've run out of years, basically. We're down to our final year, but what a good one it is. Let's get into that.
Vinyl and video. Pressing rewind on our favourite music, movies and TV.
The final year we have in store for, well, of course, we could do more if we went back to the 1930s, but I don't have too many records or movies from that era, let's be honest. Our final year in vinyl and video is none other than 1972. Those early 70s, the hippie era in this country in full swing of length of hair, certainly. Let's start off with music. Some big artists released some big records in 1972. You got Deep Purple with Machine Head. I did think about that one, Finey, but in the end, I went with I think what a lot of people would put in their most famous albums category. It is by none other than the Rolling Stones and their album from 1972, a double album, no less, Exile on Main Street. I think this might be, I think this and Let It Bleed were probably the first Stones albums I ever heard. Now, confession here, I'm not a massive Rolling Stones fan. They've always been a little too bluesy for my tastes and a little bit up and down, but their best stuff I do genuinely like. And there's plenty of best stuff on this double album, 18 tracks across four sides of vinyl. This was their 10th studio album. And, boy, it was popular with the punters. In fact, pretty sure for a short period at least, this was the biggest selling record in history. What famous Stone songs are on this? Well, Rocks Off. That's probably almost my favourite Rolling Stone song. That kicks off proceedings, followed by Rip This Joint, which is another Million Miles a Minute Stones classic. It's got Tumbling Dice, Massive Hit. It's got Happy. It's got All Down the Line. It's got Soul Survivor. Some very, very well-known Rolling Stones tracks on this record. If I was asked to pick a couple of Stones albums to tide me over for the rest of my life, I'd probably have this, I'd have Let It Bleed, and I'd have Sticky Fingers. Certainly creatively, and those albums, I'm pretty sure, all back-to-back. Let It Bleed, 1969, I think. Sticky Fingers, I think, 71. Exile on Main Street, 72. So probably the creative peak for the Rolling Stones, but a massive, massive record, very generally cited by the critics as among the most influential, most important records in rock music history. It is the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street. What have you got musically speaking, Finey?
Amazing how prolific artists were then, wasn't
they,
it?
They were. They really were, yep.
Sometimes knocking out more than one album a year. In fact, my artist had two big albums this year in 1972. And, yeah, there was some great rock and roll, great music across the Atlantic in America and England. And I've gone for something of a crooner. And I guess I'm sort of, in a way, required to make this selection. It's Al Green, whose voice I absolutely love, with his album Let's Stay Together. Why am I required to make the choice? Let's Stay Together was the song that my wife and I, Natalie and I, chose for our wedding waltz. And given that we're only less than 2 weeks away from our 25th wedding anniversary, it seems like a timely choice. The album's a beauty. Let's Stay Together is the opening track, and I think that's a pretty famous track by Al Green. But there's also How Can You Mend a Broken Heart, Old Time Lover, and I've Never Found a Girl, which are recognisable and songs I think that people would know once they heard. But Let's Stay Together, being the title track, is the mainstay of the album, and a track that I still love to this very day. People might know it from one of the Tarantino movies, Let's Stay Together, and we certainly picked it up from around that period, I think, from the Tarantino movie.
Oh, nice, Finey. You old softy. I've got to admit, Let's Stay Together might be the only Al Green song I know. Maybe there's a couple of others I'd know if I heard them.
Yep.
But I'm still reeling from the fact that it's nearly your 25th wedding anniversary, and a big hello to the long-suffering Nat, and hope someone pins a VC on the chest for surviving 25 years with the guy sharing microphone on this podcast. No mean feat at all. Sometimes 25 minutes is too much for some of us. All right, now I'm just kidding, Finey. You know I'm kidding. All right, let's talk movies. And, I was talking about a certain group of Italian gangsters before, and now I'm going to talk about another even more famous group of Italian gangsters, because movies don't come a lot better known than this one. Had to have this. There were some really good films come out in 1972. Finey, I'm sure you noticed that when you were choosing yours, but I got in first, and that meant that I had to go with The Godfather, absolute classic crime, organised crime classic from Francis Ford Coppola, one of the greatest casts ever assembled in the history of motion pictures. I speak, of course, of Marlon Brando playing Vito Corleone, Al Pacino as his son Michael, James Caan as another son, Sonny, Robert Duvall as the family lawyer, Tom Hagen, John Cazale as the third and somewhat black sheep son, Fredo. Diane Keaton playing Michael's love interest, Kay Adams. Who hasn't seen The Godfather? Is there a person listening to this podcast that hasn't seen The Godfather? Well, you owe it to yourself to rectify that situation, because it is an amazing movie. The acting is sensational. The storyline is never less than gripping. It's brilliantly shot. It's dramatic. It's full of action. It's full of subterfuge, subplots. It is just the consummate movie. And in fact, a lot of people, including my late father, who was a noted film critic, he actually thought Godfather 2 was even better than the first Godfather. But for action, you cannot beat this film. Famous scenes, just every 5 minutes. I picked out three, finally, which these are spoilers of sorts. But seriously, if you haven't seen The Godfather, you deserve spoilers. Most famous scenes, of course, the old severed horse's head in the bed when they can't get what they want. So millionaire businessman wakes up with his prized stallion's head sharing a bed with him, which is a bit of a surprise, as you might understand. The famous scene where Michael confronts a underworld rival and a corrupt police boss in the Italian restaurant and is able to arm himself during a short toilet stop and exact his horrible revenge on them for what they'd done to him and his family. What else is another? Oh, look, my favourite, personal favourite, the love interest of Michael when he, after that actor just described, flees to Sicily and marries, tragically, for only a short period, the beautiful Apollonia. Boy, is she a seriously beautiful woman. The juxtaposition towards the end, the climax of the film, the juxtaposition of the baptism that the Corleone family is attending, interspersed with hits being simultaneously conducted on various rival gang bosses. There are famous scenes literally every 2 or 3 minutes in this film, but it's just a wonderful, wonderful movie and cinema at its finest. Can't recommend it highly enough. Certainly one of my favourite few movies of all time. The Godfather. Did I leave anything out there, Finey?
That was beautifully surmised.
Well, thank you.
There's some sleeping with the fishes to be done. And it's great, isn't it?
Luca Brasi. In fact, there's a Tasmanian rock band called Luca Brasi, named after the man who sleeps with the fishes.
Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes. Yes. Well, I reckon your choice could almost be identified, definitely could be identified by the theme music, couldn't it?
Oh, yes. Yep.
Well, I think my choice could be recognised by the theme music as well.
Do the theme music first.
It's just a little bit harder.
Do you want me to do it?
Yeah, you do it.
No, it sounds like the Beverly Hillbillies. I can't do it. You're right, I can't. What are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about the banjo picking from the movie Deliverance. Now, Deliverance is not an easy movie to watch, I would have thought. It stars John Voight, Burt Reynolds, Ned Beatty and Ronnie Cox. And they're four businessmen from Atlanta who decide to go on a canoeing adventure in northern Georgia, up in the hills. And basically, the scene was set sort of Ozark-type setting. I'm not sure if it actually is the Ozarks, but for the 48 years since that movie was made, people in remote areas in the south of the USA feel that they've paid the price for that deliverance mentality. I guess everything, what happens next would be a spoiler alert, and I'm not going to ruin it for the listeners because not everybody has seen Deliverance, but it's a movie worth seeing. Let's just say if the suggestion in this movie is that if you go deep enough into the unexplored parts of the USA, you're going to run into some backwoods people. And when I say backwoods, I don't mean backwards. I mean backwoods, living in the back of the woods. You're going to run into those sort of people that, let's just say, might have the same uncle as father, if you know what I mean. And you'll never forget the term squeal like a pig. I'll give you that much as a spoiler. What happens is at times hard to watch, but it is one heck of a movie and it's a bit of a sort of horror thriller and famous. And as I say, people who live in that part of America blame it for prejudices against them ever since.
Yeah, great, great movie, good choice. If you haven't seen it, by the way, at least get on YouTube and have a look at the dueling banjo scene, because it is it's good fun. But the kid playing the banjo, who does play the banjo for the, is it Burt Reynolds? Which one of them's playing the banjo?
Drew, and Drew is played by Ronnie Cox.
Well, that yeah, great scene, but that is one scary looking kid playing the banjo.
Yep.
The other banjo. It freaks me out just looking at him. I don't know what the story is there, but anyway, yeah, it is a great movie. They are two pretty sizable movies to choose from in the year of 1972. Let's move on to TV. I've gone local, finally. Had to go with this. Couldn't find a lot overseas that interested me, to be honest. But I remember as a little kid being right into this show, and talk about a cult show in your own country. I'm speaking about the Auntie Jack Show, with Graham Bond playing the much-loved Auntie Jack. And if you're not of our vintage, you'll be going, who the hell is Auntie Jack? Well, call her up on the internet. She is a fearsome-looking woman with a huge billowing dress worn with work boots and footy socks, and a pretty rough head with a moustache. And her signature phrase, of course, was, I'll rip your bloody arms off. And that became a much-loved Australian catch cry in the early 70s. Auntie Jack's sidekick was the also much-loved Thin Arthur, who was decked out in top hat and tails and was a bit of a showman and singer, and accompanied Auntie Jack on piano a lot. He was played by Rory O'Donoghue, who sadly passed away only a couple of years ago after it emerged having been plagued by depression for a long time. It's a very sad story, actually. But Thin Arthur and Auntie Jack were the staples of this show. What was it like? Well, it was a bit like Monty Python's Flying Circus, I think it's probably the best analogy, and sort of ironic in a way that those two shows literally started on Australian TV, I think, on the same evening. And Monty Python, of course, would become another cult classic. But sort of sketch comedy, bit of pantomime, very, very Australian for its era, but really was a cult favourite. Very short-lived, really. There was only two seasons of the Auntie Jack Show and only a total of 13 episodes plus two specials, one of which I remember vividly. That it was Auntie Jack and Thin Arthur who officially introduced colour TV to Australia on the 1st of March 1975, and they started doing their show, I think, at 3 minutes to midnight in black and white, and then on the stroke of midnight, it the black and white washed off the screen and became glorious colour, if indeed you had purchased a colour TV, which my family hadn't at that stage. And I remember I actually got up at the age of 10, I got up just to see the arrival of colour TV on Australian screens, knowing I wasn't going to see colour, but somehow hoping beyond hope that magically on the stroke of midnight, our TV would turn into colour, even though it was a black and white TV. God, I was an idiot. As you'd imagine, I was disappointed when that, in fact, didn't happen. But the Auntie Jack Show, bit of a cult classic, and plenty of highlights, I think, on YouTube if you want to have a look. All right, what's your TV offering?
Well, my TV offering is one of TV's real mega shows. And again, another show that was easily recognised by its theme music. And that was da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I won't do it. Suicide is Painless,
the
version of the TV show MASH. And were you a fan?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't watch it all the time, but yeah, I watched plenty of it. Yeah, I was a fan.
11 seasons. The actors that were on all of 11 seasons were Alan Alda as Hawkeye and Loretta Swit as Hot Lips. Otherwise, we had Wayne Rogers playing Trapper in the first three seasons, McLean Stevenson as Colonel Blake, Larry Linville as the ferret-faced Frank Burns, a recipient of much flack from Hawkeye and Trapper, Gary Berghoff, who played... And he was the one actor who was actually in the movie and the TV series, playing Radar O'Reilly. Mike Farrell came on as BJ Honeycutt. Henry Morgan came on as Colonel Sherman Potter. Jamie Farr, of course, as Klinger. And William Christopher, Father Mulcahy, David Ogden Steers as the replacement of Frank Burns and... what was his name? The doctor. I had them all except for him. It'll come to me. The pompous Boston doctor, thoracic surgeon from Boston General Hospital. But it's a TV series that started pretty raunchy, very similar to the movie. There was a lot of interplay between the doctors and the nurses, and I guess sort of to meet American cultural change, as the show went into the early 80s, became a lot cleaner and there was less infidelity and more, I guess, almost preaching from the pulpit. So in the end, it became a little bit of a preaching show and not necessarily as funny as it was at the beginning. But, of course, the last episode, MASH, Goodbye, Farewell and Amen, at the time was the most watched TV show in American history. So it certainly holds its place as one of the great TV shows of all time in terms of viewership, and I certainly enjoyed watching it, probably earlier rather than later.
Yeah, I remember that final episode, the build-up to that, and how it was reported all over the world. Funny how the message of it and the tone of it changed, given that it was all supposedly set in the confines of the Korean War.
Yep. Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, good show, MASH. Certainly one of the superior sitcoms of its time.
I just remembered the name of David Ogden Stier's character, Charles Emerson Winchester III.
Ah, yes, of course. I was going to say Frazier Crane, but that was a different show and a different sort of doctor. Let's finish off with a footy memory. I couldn't go past this one, Finey. Think football 1972 and you immediately think the most incredible scoring feast in grand final history. An amazing, amazing scoreline between Carlton and Richmond. Just to give you a bit of context, Carlton had finished on top of the ladder, but Richmond went into that grand final hot favourites. That is because they'd beaten Carlton twice during the regular season, drawn the second semi-final against them, but won the replay very convincingly by 41 points. Carlton had a not overly convincing preliminary final win over your Saints, Finey, and was a massive underdog going into this grand final. Well, it's fair to say they stunned the Tigers. Captain coach John Nicholls sprung a catalogue of positional switches. None the least, he took himself out of the ruck, stationed himself in a forward pocket alongside Alex Jesolinko with Robert Walls at centre-half forward. Percy Jones went into the first ruck and duly played the game of his life. And the directions were to keep it open, get the ball down to the goal face quickly. That the Blues certainly did. To wit, in the first quarter, they scored a record 8 goals, 4, 52. Richmond not too shabby either. The Tigers kicking 5. So 3-goal lead at quarter time. The second quarter, Carlton kicked 10 goals, 2 to the Tigers, 5 again. 5-5. The scoreline at half time of the grand final, 18-6, 114. The Blues, 45 points up on the hapless Richmond, 10-9, 69. The whole game is available to watch on YouTube. Check it out because it is just unbelievable football. Another 7 goals added by the Blues in the third term, and just 3 goals for them in the last. But just a record-breaking day. The final scores, Carlton winning by 27 points in the end, Richmond adding 7 goals of their own in the last quarter. 28-9, 177 Carlton, defeating Richmond, 22-18, 150. Now, this scoreline is just so out of whack with, any other grand final scores in history, so much so that not only was Carlton's score a record and remains a record, but Richmond's losing score of 22-18-150 equaled the previous highest grand final score. Goal kickers, Alex Jasilenko kicked 7, become one of a number of players to kick 7 in a grand final. John Nicholls, masterstroke tactically, he kicked 6. And Robert Walls played one of the great individual grand finals, kicked 6 from centre-half forward, but also featured in, cop this, 7 goal assists. So Robert Walls directly responsible for 13 of Carlton's 28 goals. An amazing game played by him, an incredible game. And Richmond were stung, absolutely stung and shocked by this defeat, and would get their own back next year in 73 when they played the Blues again, and a much tougher game ensued, which we've talked about previously. But just an incredible game in 1972 grand final, and the Blues producing one of their most famous performances of all time. Finey.
You know, that afternoon, of course, Richmond's losing score would have been the highest score ever in a grand final. Reminds me of that one-day international at Johannesburg at the Wanderers in 2006, when Australia made 434, which was the highest ever score in a one-day international, only to be run down by the South Africans, who obviously, in beating Australia for a short time, held the crown as the highest ever score. Both happened in the same game.
That's right. Didn't poor old, was it Mick Lewis, I think, copped an absolute hammering by the South Africans that day.
Okay, so my 1972 memory is something a little bit different, but it was the year I began my love affair with footy cards. And I just remember collecting footy cards in that year. Now, the footy cards of that year on the front had the image of the player with the yellow and white sort of cross hashes behind it. And, of course, on the reverse side, they had a jigsaw puzzle, a scene from the 1971 grand final. And I remember one of the cards just had a boot with a St Kilda sock in it. And that always struck me as very collectible. But I remember some of the players in that first set in 1972. I just loved footy cards. You know, I know people talk about the stick of gum and the wax paper wrapping that they came in, and they were all very memorable, you know, sort of our sights and smells of our childhood. But I remember the St Kilda players in that series. There was a Stuart Trott, Barry Bream was in it, Travis Pays, Gary Colling. And I remember other players from other teams. I remember getting a Hayden McAuliffe from South Melbourne, with Hayden with a very, very blue sky behind him. I think they used to enhance the blue of the sky shots behind the players. And it was just a great set of cards. I remember Ian Salmon from Footscray was one of the cards.
I remember, it was the first year I collected them. I remember the front had the sort of yellow checks, yellow and white.
So we started in the same year, and it's just a love affair that I've kept up most of my life. I just love those footy cards from 1972.
Yeah, 72, 73 were the 2 years I went hammer and tongs on the footy cards. And you're right, the making up the pictures on the back, that was the highlight for me. And I remember the picture on the back was from the previous year's grand final. I'm pretty sure Carl Dittrich featured in the picture on the back in that of the 72 series. Finey, correct?
Yeah, I believe you're correct.
All right, good memory. A lot of people of our vintage certainly were heavily into footy cards back in the day, which is, it's only It's only 50-odd years ago. just a mere skip down memory lane. All right, that is it for Vinyl and Video. Like I said, that could be it permanently for Vinyl and Video, but we may just think of another device to enable us to keep crapping on about nostalgia, because we do tend to do that a fair bit, I know. But there is only one way to finish off this podcast, Viney, and that is with a cracking good rant. And let's do that right now.
On Footyology, the rant off.
All right, Viney, we haven't touched on this, but one of the major news events of the past week was the spat between Facebook and the Australian federal government, which saw news organisations barred from posting news links on Facebook. It's pretty serious stuff, and I've done a pretty serious rant on it. So I would like to deliver that in suitably serious fashion now, and I'd like you to seriously count me in.
3, 2, 1, Rowan.
I'm pissed off with Facebook, Viney, but that's not all. I'm pissed off with the federal government, and I'm pissed off with this country's major media outlets. That's a hat trick of pissed offedness, but certainly not a hat trick I'm celebrating. In case you're on Mars last week, Facebook, that social media monster, decided to flex its considerable muscle in an ongoing stoush with Canberra and the big media players about paying for news content. Mark Zuckerberg and his mates took the pretty heavy-handed step of ceasing to publish any Australian news links on their platform. Not quite what the government and the likes of News Corp was after. On Tuesday, a truce of sorts was reached. But the whole episode is just another example of a Titanic-sized shipwreck, which is the media in this country, and the powerlessness of the political system to do anything constructive about it. Who was hurt most in the standoff? Well, it wasn't the likes of The Age or The Herald Sun. Yes, they get plenty of traffic out of links posted on Facebook, but for them, it's not the be-all and end-all. Who it hurt most were the hundreds of smaller, independent media operations like Footyology. We get a fair percentage of our page views via Facebook. Unlike News Corp or Nine, however, we don't have millions of dollars to explore alternatives of getting our news out there. So where does that leave us if Facebook tries this tactic on again? Frankly, in big trouble. Even if there is a deal brokered which satisfies the big media players, Facebook and government, the one thing of which you can be certain is that it won't have been struck with the aims of media diversity and maintaining quality journalism in mind. And it again underlines the importance of subscriptions to smaller outlets. If that sounds like a sob story in a begging mission, you're right, it is. We're in trouble unless we can start generating some serious revenue via our Patreon page. So if you're hearing this and you're still not an official Footyology patron, please get on board via the links on our website. That is, if you want to continue listening to this podcast and not just bump into Finey or I washing your windscreen while dodging cars on the corner of Punt Road and Swan Street. It was an ordinary effort by Facebook, but it was no less an ordinary effort from ScoMo and his Liberal Party mates in Canberra. Why have they gone so hard on this legislation? Simple. It's about nothing more than their attempts to keep sweet with one man, Rupert Bloody Murdoch. Murdoch has never quite grasped the internet, Finey, and he hates the thought of competition. So as per usual, he's trying to wipe it out. Does that worry the government? Of course not. Not if it means pleasing their spiritual master, which they already do via a daily stream of little more than government propaganda in the Herald Sun, Daily Telegraph, Courier Mail, Adelaide Advertiser, and, of course, on that channel for wacko Sky News, not to mention those mysterious government grants they keep funnelling out to Foxtel. As for the likes of Nine Newspapers and Seven West Media, you're no better. You keep talking the talk about fiercely independent journalism and sticking up for the little guy, but when comes time to make a choice between actually walking the walk or snatching a few extra coins that have fallen on the floor, you go for the latter every time. Hang on, I hear you say. Aren't you talking about former colleagues? Well, yes, I am. Sadly, former colleagues, many of whom have proved to be full of you-know-what. We're not just taking this lying down, Finey. Now more than ever, quality, independent and uncompromised journalism is important. Footyology is going to keep going as long as we can. You guys out there listening to this have been great supporters, and we need that support to continue. So get on board, become a Footyology patron, retweet our links, spread the gospel about the podcast, get your family and friends on board. And if they ask why, tell them it may just be the difference between getting to hear about who is actually winning the footy and why, or having to be content with yet another Herald Sun list of AFL football's most powerful wags. It's their choice.
Brilliant, Rowan. Absolutely brilliant. A great call to arms. Beautifully said.
Thank you. All right. Serious stuff over. I'm hoping you'll lighten the mood a bit. 3, 2, 1, rant.
Your wish is my command because, look, I was watching TV last night, New Zealand Bake Off, and I was taken by the New Zealand accent, sort of grated on me in the finish, all the sixes and sevens. And I started to think about accents. And I don't know whether you've ever given it much thought, Rowan, but I feel that the Australian accent is completely neutral. The rest of the world does not feel the same way. I've travelled to America. I've been in bars in New York, you know, the classic New Yorker accent. And I've ordered a beer and they've got no idea what I've ordered. People have asked me what my name is. I say Mark and they go, Mac. I say Mark. And finally they go, oh, Mark. Realising that maybe the Australian accent isn't as neutral as I think. I mean, can you believe this? Take Scottish football scores, for example. Here's a few from days gone by. Scores from Scotland. Dumbarton 2, Stenhouse Muir 0. Ullo Athletic 1, Queen of the South 2. Academicals of Hamilton 0. Raith Rovers 4. Now, can you believe that the Scots believe they have no accent whatsoever? And that we're the ones with the accent? How about my Cockney mates? Hello, Marky. Coming down to the old rubbity dub. Going to fling the arrows this afternoon. Going to play some darts, mate. I'll catch you on the manor. I beg your pardon? Even my northerner mate, Bollocks. Hey, Marky, come up to pub for game of darts. He reckons he doesn't have an accent. And as for the South Africans with their, yo, did you see Pretorius? Oh, what a game he played, eh? Again, accent-free, we're the ones with the accent. Well, fair dinkum, mate, struth. You know what? I'll leave the last word to a famous New York stand-up comedian whose material was particularly Jewish by the name of Jackie Mason. And Jackie Mason used to say, you know what? At the end of one of my shows, I get a few complaints. And generally, it's not from the Gentiles, but it's from the Jews. And he said, once I had a little lady come up to me and she said, you know the problem with your show, Mr. Mason? The problem is you make us all sound too Jewish. Blah, 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 blah. Why can't you talk like a real person? Why can't you talk like me?
That's a poison. That's almost a New York Jew, isn't it? That's even.
Yeah, well, that's who he was being assaulted by. Why can't you talk like a real person? Why can't you talk like me?
No, that was very good. I enjoy your accent work. I was just a bit disappointed you didn't do the Scottish football score on, which I actually heard one day. Isn't it?
East 5-4, 4-5.
Yeah. Isn't it Firth of Forth or something?
No, it's East 5 and 4-5.
4-5, yeah. 4-5-4. Nice work. Suitably light note on which to finish. That's it for today. A quick plug to our sponsors in an Australian accent, if you will, Friday.
The very best burgers in town, mate. 144 Bridport Street, Albert Park. Andrew's Hamburgers. Was that suitably Aussie?
It was.
How about West Point Properties, the best builds in the southeastern Melbourne? Contact Nick Spartels, West Point Properties, for your renos and your new home builds, mate.
Cobber. All right. Thanks, Cobb. That is it for this week. Thanks to your company. Look, that rant I did was serious, I know, but look, I can't stress this enough. We really are reliant on the goodwill of our audience. So please, if you can spare $5 US a month, jump on our Patreon page and become a subscriber. You can make donations at the Acast supporter page, wherever you're listening to this podcast. But rest assured, we absolutely value your support. You've been a fantastic audience over the years, and we hope to keep this operation going as long as we can, with or without the support of certain social media behemoths. That is it for this week. We'll see you back as we creep ever closer to the start of the 2021 AFL men's season. Have a great week, everyone. We'll speak to you next week.